Hey, you. Stop. Quit it. Knock it off. Okay, now I sound like one of those answering machine messages from back when we all first discovered that you could pretend a real-life person was there and trick your caller. But I am serious about the stopping thing. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. And this week, we're focused on stopping and quitting. Cutting off bad financial behavior or ending longstanding corporate habits, even a story of how an impasse over a budget is hurting school kids. And as you heard me say last week, we're focused on incorporating your stories into the show as we grow it. That means we want you to go to our website, marketplaceweekend.org, the Marketplace Facebook page, and our Twitter, at MarketplaceWKND. We've got a poll about stopping bad financial habits and a place for you to give us your thoughts. We're going to start this week with quitting. Not a job, but bad stuff. The things you do with money that you know you shouldn't do. They drain your bank account, hurt your earning potential. Lauren Lyons Cole made a list of common financial habits that we ought to quit, and she emailed it to us. And we made the list into a poll and put it on our website, marketplaceweekend.org, to get a sense of things maybe you guys want to quit. And I am sad to report that your habits need a little work. So we brought Lauren on. She's a regular on the show and a certified financial planner. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Lizzie.
I want to start with this one. We asked people if they make impulse purchases, and 67% of the people who responded said yes, 33% said no. So impulse purchases seem like they are up there in terms of bad financial habits we make.
You know, I saw a study recently that said we spend about $115,000 over the course of our lifetime on impulse purchases.
$115,000?
$115,000. Yeah. So that's a lot of money. Just think of the number of vacations you could take, or the nicer house you could have bought if you just left some of those little small things on the shelf at Target and didn't take them home with you. So, you know, it really does add up.
You told us that not negotiating your first salary can have a pretty big impact on your earning potential later in life. And we asked people if they negotiated their first salary. 78% said no, and only 22% said yes. Why is this a mistake, not negotiating at the beginning?
Well, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but mathematically, if you can negotiate an extra $5,000 in your first salary, and, you know, it obviously depends on your industry, but let's just start with $5,000, that adds up to $500,000 in extra income over the course of your lifetime. So this is actually higher value. You could make all the impulse purchases you want if you just negotiate this one $5,000 raise.
So we're going to leave the rest of the poll up on our site and people can take it. But I want to get into kind of why we make these poor choices to begin with. And some of it, I would guess, is ignorance. I mean, if you're 21 years old, how are you going to know that you're supposed to negotiate?
I think ignorance is a lot of it. Obviously, we're not learning these things in school. A lot of our families aren't necessarily talking openly about money, which is why it's so important for parents to kind of shift that dynamic and talk about these sorts of things with their kids from a young age. Not that they're always going to listen, but it's worth it to try to get these lessons into their minds, because even just small shifts can make a big difference.
What are some other things you have seen when you advise clients, kind of like bad habits we make?
Well, I think the bad habits, it kind of comes from two different angles. Either you're really comfortable. So maybe right now you're in a pretty good job. You feel secure. You've got extra income, so you don't really have to think about it. And in those cases, I think out of convenience or laziness or just out of habit, we make bad habits. And that can happen. But also sometimes I also see people who are kind of in a bad situation and they feel in over their heads, and it's just too overwhelming to try to shift their behaviors right now. So they just continue in this pattern of making bad choices. And at some point, in order to improve your situation, you really have to break the cycle.
That's the theme of our show this week, stopping. So let's say you know something's out there. You aren't disciplined about fees, for example, or something else. How do you stop?
One of the best ways to stop, you know, it's very hard to limit yourself. Nobody really wants to do that. Some people are better at it than others. My advice would be to actually take a bigger picture perspective, right? So choose some sort of large goal. It might be a trip to Italy. It might be buying a new car. It could be starting a business, something that will motivate you intrinsically so that you can start to make those changes, you know, so be more careful with overdraft fees, for instance, or upping your savings percentage because you're trying to work towards something exciting, not, you know, it's rather than limiting yourself, it's more about reaching something that's exciting.
So it sounds like it's almost kind of turning the psychology of this around so that you feel like you're working towards something positive.
Right. Money can be so stressful. So you have to turn it. You have to make it fun. Really, that's the one way I've seen it work with clients.
Let's say you're listening to this and you're kind of like, yeah, that all sounds great, but I am struggling to stop paying the minimum on my student loans or my credit card. And it all seems too overwhelming to change. What do you do in that scenario?
Well, so here's the thing. When it comes to financial planning in general, we tend to think that it's this easy, you know, we can always save 15% towards retirement. We can always pay a little extra towards our student loans. The reality is there are times in our lives where we can't. But these times are temporary. They're finite. And you have to have that perspective. You have to realize right now you might be just getting by. And that's okay. But make sure that you have a longer term perspective. Are you looking for a new job? Is there a way that you could negotiate in your current job? Is there something that you could cut back on? Could you move to a less expensive apartment? So it's okay to just be getting by as long as you're kind of thinking long term and making sure you're not stuck in that position forever. You really won't be.
Lauren Lyons-Cole, thank you so much for coming on.
Always a pleasure, Lizzie.
You heard me talk about working your stories into the show, and we're starting an ongoing conversation. I'm going to crib from Ronald Reagan, because this is what we want to know. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Why or why not? And no, this isn't just about the election. It's about how you feel about the economy, your prospects, your kids' prospects. So come tell us. Visit our website, marketplaceweekend.org, write us there, or leave us a voicemail. You can go to the Marketplace Facebook page, too, or our Twitter, at MarketplaceWKND. We're going to take your responses and build on them throughout the next few weeks and months. If you've ever had a moment, and I admit I have had them on weekends, when you could really go for an Egg McMuffin, but it is after 10:30 a.m., you are not alone. The thing is, of course, that McDonald's stopped selling its breakfast menu mid-morning. No longer. Starting this upcoming week, most franchises will be offering breakfast all day long. Not every item, but quite a few. Marketplace's Annie Baxter got a special look at how this is going to work.
McDonald's has been toying with the idea of all-day breakfast for a long time. Customers like Lisa Jorgensen help you understand why.
Absolutely. When you want your Egg McMuffin, you want your Egg McMuffin. You know what I'm saying?
But there were reasons for McDonald's to hold back.
The main reason is we don't have enough room in our kitchens to cook everything at once.
This is a video posted to McDonald's YouTube channel last year. An Australian worker is explaining how tricky it is to keep offering breakfast items throughout the day when you've got limited grill and countertop space.
Because we're so busy at breakfast, some grills are dedicated to one food item only, such as eggs. Our ready-to-heat hotcakes also take up space which we need to make our burgers, as you can see right here.
But McDonald's U.S. franchise owners ultimately voted in favor of extended breakfast.
So you're going to handle the muffins?
All-day breakfast launched a few weeks early at this McDonald's. It's in North Branch, a small town in Minnesota. Predrag Dostanich is the owner of the place. He prefers to go by his nickname.
I'm Dos, okay?
Dos, okay.
Dos says the changes have been easy to implement, partly because the all-day breakfast menu is limited. For example, restaurants will offer either a muffin or a biscuit sandwich, but not both.
Minnesota is a market where people like more muffin sandwich.
Dos and the store manager order up an Egg McMuffin to show how it's prepared during a dinner rush.
We're going to watch it come alive.
To avoid crowding the grill with breakfast foods, Dos has purchased some new equipment, including an extra egg cooker.
So that's it sizzling here.
McDonald's corporate helps cover some of the equipment costs, which run from $500 to $5,000. Now, things are not going perfectly with our Egg McMuffin. The worker overcooks the muffins. They're a bit burnt. Dos winces and says, "You're killing me."
"You're killing me."
Now, to be fair, you could imagine the workers are pretty distracted with a microphone in their faces. And the sandwich actually gets assembled so quickly, I lose track of it.
So it is over here now.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, where is it?
Suddenly, it's ready.
There is no interaction, there's no issue.
But you can see the potential headaches, like having to explain to customers that they can't get any old breakfast item they want around the clock.
I really like the steak sandwich.
You would not have a steak sandwich.
And when someone orders breakfast at the drive-thru...
Two breakfast burritos and one sausage egg McMuffin.
She learns the sausage McMuffin gets made to order at this time of day, and it's going to take an extra 5 minutes. The customer frowns, changes her order.
No, let's do a third sausage burrito.
That last part, waiting for food,
yes,
is something
please.
Some McDonald's customers already complain about. Bob Golden is a food industry expert at the research firm Technomic, and he says as McDonald's adds more complexity with all-day breakfast, things could get worse.
The more products they add, it can have the effect of slowing down service time and increasing error rates.
But chain restaurant consultant Julene Beck says a key strategy for rejuvenating sales is to change up the menu. And if you do it by offering more of something people already like, namely breakfast.
It's as close to a, quote, no-brainer, close quote, as possible. It's not something that's unknown.
The other potential upside for McDonald's? Breakfast food typically costs less than burgers to make. So increasing breakfast food sales can potentially juice profits.
That's our own Annie Baxter. Coming up on the show, imagine a world without performance reviews. It sounds pretty awesome. Rejoice, America. It's happening. Now let's look at some of the biggest numbers in the news this week. Every day, Marketplace's By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them at marketplace.org. Here are Marketplace producers Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with a look at some of the other economic stories of the week by the numbers. Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is...
20 channels.
If you get the new TiVo Bolt, you'll be able to skip commercials guilt-free on that many channels.
The device will mark the starts and ends of commercial breaks, and with the push of a button, you can jump right past the ads.
But you'll only be able to use it on recorded shows, not live TV or sports.
$125 a day.
That's where the World Bank's extreme poverty line currently cuts off.
They're expected to raise it to $1.90.
The higher amount accounts for things like cell phones and other new essentials in developing countries.
1 to 5 stars.
That's a rating scale of a new app called People with 2 E's.
The app lets users rate people the same way they might rate a restaurant or a new movie.
Oh, Raghu, I actually found your rating.
Oh, really?
Right here. It says solid sense of humor.
Okay.
It's true. Showed up 30 minutes late.
Okay, that was like one time and there was like traffic
haircut
on the freeway.
Looked a little weird. 1 star.
Oh, come on.
When we talk about stopping or quitting, we definitely have to talk about oil this week. The last company drilling in the Arctic, Shell, says it's not going to do that anymore. That's after spending $7 billion over 7 years to try to extract oil off the Alaskan coast. Now, some of this is because oil fields weren't panning out, and some is because of the low prices that we talked about a few shows back. But we wanted to tell you a side of the story you probably haven't heard before, what this means for the people who depend on oil for their economy. To do that, we've got Holly Bell. She's a professor of business and public policy at the University of Alaska in Anchorage. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Shell was kind of the last game in town in drilling in the Arctic. What's the reaction been like in Alaska this week to this announcement?
Well, the reaction's been mixed. For those who had environmental concerns about Shell's drilling in the Arctic, they were pretty excited about the idea that they were going away. However, for those of us who are concerned about the economy of Alaska, it was a real sock in the gut, if you will, for those of us who are concerned about the economy.
Tell me a little bit about what role oil plays in the economy in Alaska, because it's a complicated picture and it affects everybody in the state the way the tax structure is set up.
It really does. Royalties and taxes from oil production fund about 90% of Alaska's budget. So as you can imagine, that you know, right now, this year, we have a $3.5 billion budget shortfall just based on the price of oil going down. And so we need more oil for two reasons. We need to increase our revenues for the state. We also need to make sure that the oil pipeline has more oil so it can continue to operate.
Even if you don't work in the oil industry in Alaska, it affects your
economic life. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. In Alaska, we have something called the permanent fund dividend, and about 25% of oil money since 1976 has been put into this fund, this permanent fund. And the purpose of the fund is to conserve a portion of the state's revenue for a time when oil income is gone. And right now, that fund stands at about $50 billion. And what happens every year is if you're every man, woman, and child in the state of Alaska who's been a resident here for at least a year receives what's called the permanent fund dividend check. And that check is based on the five-year rolling average of investment returns on that fund. And that is redistributed then to the citizens of Alaska.
About how much money are we talking about?
Well, the time I've been here, I've seen it as low as around $700. And this year, it's $2,072, which, not adjusting for inflation, is the highest payout we've seen in the state of Alaska.
When you look at oil prices now, they're low. They've been low for some time. And a lot of oil companies are essentially saying, this just doesn't work for us on an economic level to put this much money in to, you know, something like drilling. Does that make people around you, do you think, worried about Alaska's economic future?
Absolutely. You know, while low oil prices can be a good thing for the country as a whole, because anytime we can reduce the cost of inputs for production of goods or services, that's helpful to the economy. It means cheaper oil, cheaper gasoline, cheaper products and services. So for the rest of the country, it's a very good thing that oil prices are falling. But as far as the economy of Alaska goes, it's very concerning. With this $3.5 billion budget shortfall, we don't really have any particular way of solving that in the near term that's in sight. And so a lot of us here are very concerned about the future fiscal health of the state of Alaska. It's potentially 20 to 25 years before they may be back to try something like that again. So this could be a very long-term issue for the state.
Are there other ways that the state can make up the money? I mean, after all, it seems like unemployment is still relatively low in the area.
It is, and there's several reasons for that. One reason is that the oil fields that we have up here in Alaska, they're a little harder to shut down production and cap. So they have to continue to drill at least a little bit and produce a little bit of oil. So there is still oil field jobs in the state. And so unemployment has remained pretty steady, at least here in the short run. But in the long run, we have to figure out how in the world we're going to solve this $3.5 billion budget shortfall. So there's several ways we can do that. First, obviously, is budget cuts. We're already starting to see that happen. The next thing that we can do is we can tap the $12 billion budget reserve fund that the state of Alaska has. But at this rate, those funds could be gone as early as 2018. So then we start to have to look at things like state income taxes, removing the permanent fund dividend or reducing it, or having a state sales tax to replace that revenue.
Is there a conversation happening in Alaska now about having a more diverse economy that is not so reliant on one industry like oil for so much revenue?
There are discussions going on at the moment. Right now, we have three primary industries in Alaska. We have tourism, fishing, and oil. Of course, in addition to oil, there's other mineral deposits and things like that that we have that we may be able to develop more of. One problem, though, is sometimes getting permission from the federal government to utilize lands to do those types of things. But yes, we are looking at it. And the problem is it's difficult. Our geographic location makes it difficult. We're never going to be, for example, a manufacturing center. So there's a lot of limitations as to what we can do. We can't really expand fishing because we can't overfish. We want to maintain a sustainable resource. And so the prospects are minimal for Alaska.
Shell had invested, you know, $7 billion in this project. What happens on a really granular level when that money leaves?
Well, we have several issues that could happen. First of all, in the short run, I think we're going to see more things like taxation on people in the state to help cover the budget. But in the long run, if oil production goes away, for example, That would be a very difficult time for the state of Alaska. And if that happens, we could then see some mass migration out of Alaska. And if you think about it, before there was oil in this state, the population was about two-thirds what it is right now. So assuming we go back to a pre-oil population, we may have as many as two-thirds of the people in the state of Alaska leaving.
Holly Bell, Professor of Business Administration and Economics at the University of Alaska, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Now, here is a delightful thought. How relieved would you be if this year at work, you didn't have to come up with a list of deliverable goals for your boss, or maybe chart your own strengths and weaknesses, attach a numerical value to your year? Yeah. Some companies are stopping annual performance reviews. Jean Sahadi wrote about this for CNN Money, where she's a senior writer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Lizzie.
So who's getting rid of performance reviews and why are they doing it?
A bunch of companies. About 6% of the Fortune 1000 companies have gotten rid of their rankings and are changing how they deliver performance reviews to their employees. No longer will it be the once a year, the only time you talk to your manager about your projects and how you did and what your raise is. And an increasing number are also looking at changing it in the next year or two. About 46% of companies are considering that. And really big companies, you know, GE, Microsoft, Cigna, The Gap, Deloitte, Accenture. You know, so they're conservative companies that are actually figuring out, you know what, this annual review thing, it's not working for us.
So one of the questions I have is why now? Are there certain things about changes in companies or changes in the economy that are driving this?
Well, you know, I think the millennial thing is really pushing them. I had done another story a while ago. A lot of corporations are kind of trying to loosen their collars and kind of keep up with the kids from 25 to 35 who want a much looser, more informal but supportive environment in which to work, because that is the largest segment of the workforce now and will be for years to come. The idea is to motivate employees, not to make them feel bad, because going forward, they're not going to want to do well for you. So ultimately, companies are making these changes for their bottom line. And they're hearing from researchers, look, this is how, you know, you'll do better if you motivate your employees and they're happier and they feel more comfortable talking to you and you support them.
Well, one of the things you pointed out when you wrote about this was this is kind of a big time suck for people. So I emailed my boss and said, how much time would you say you spend doing annual reviews? And I'm going to read word for word, the top of her email says, oh, holy crap, holy crap. Yeah, well, so she says it takes her about 2 to 3 full days. She's got about 9 direct reports, but also says she thinks that, you know, they are worth doing. So succinctly, can you tell me what the new wisdom is on how you do these things and how you make them kind of more timely and maybe more motivating?
Well, in terms of talking to your employees more frequently, so if I'm doing a project and my manager doesn't like what I'm doing, it's much more effective for him to step in and tell me right then and there or within a month of that time than it is to tell me at the end of the year. So that's more useful information to me. In addition, I will feel more supported, the theory goes, if my manager checks in with me and says, hey, how are you doing? What can I do to help you meet your goals? I think it's not necessarily going to be much less of a time suck the way they're setting it up, because managers have to have more conversations. So it's taking a big chunk of time you might spend once a year, and it's spreading it out over the course of the year.
You named some of these big companies doing this. Do you think this is a trend we're going to see sort of continue as the workforce moves forward?
Well, they're asking managers to do more. They're saying, look, we want you to coach these guys. We want you to know what their goals are, what their hopes are for growing their career, and we want you to support them. So it's almost a new job for managers in this new world. Whether they do that well or not, who can say? And a lot of the companies that have started to do this are doing pilot programs. So they're doing it with one part of their company, and they're seeing how it goes and seeing if they want to branch out and apply it to the rest of their divisions. And a couple of companies I talked to, they're about to do that in 2016. So there's no results yet. We don't really know how this is going to go.
Jean Sahadi, senior writer for CNN Money. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
every day, you and I interact with the world of tech. Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So this week, our theme is stopping, quitting, coming to an end. And we're going to talk about stopping some of our, shall we say, annoying tech habits.
Yes, Lizzie. First, let's start with a little bit of the lay of the land when it comes to just how much our habits have changed in recent years. The average white-collar worker spends 6.3 hours checking their email these days, and it's estimated that there will be
6.3 hours per day?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes, and it's estimated there will be a billion tablet users around the world by the end of this year. Of course, the smartphone is probably the biggest part of this. According to Pew, a majority of U.S. adults, 64%, now own a smartphone. That change has come just in the past few years. 7% of Americans say their smartphone is actually the only way they access the internet. So it's important to point out, Lizzie, that this number is really different when we're talking about people's socioeconomic status. For a lot of people in low-income households, our new devices are actually the only way we access the internet. So I think it's important for us to remember before we talk about our terrible habits with our technology and not suggest, you know, everybody throw
get
out their smartphone
this.
Or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, let's talk about our annoying habits. What
okay, because there are a lot of them, I think. I guess we should talk about the things that rank up there in terms of the most offensive, the things that perhaps might grease the social wheels a bit better if we quit.
Yes. And Lizzie, I suppose this priority or this list of the worst probably depends on who you're talking to, right? But here are just a couple. Taking photos with your massive iPad while you're at an event or a play or something like that, blocking the view of others. Looking at your phone while driving. This is a habit that is actually proven to be very dangerous.
Indeed. I went in a simulator at the University of Iowa that shows you just how quickly, you know, sending a text or looking at your phone can cause a crash.
It's really problematic, and we've seen a lot of, you know, PSA campaigns around this. There's been research that suggests screen use in bed is bad for your health and for your sex life, Lizzie.
Okay.
Using your phone around the dinner table is, of course, something that's not considered to be very polite in some circles. My personal most hated is the people who aren't even yet out of the subway in the morning and they're pulling out their phone to look at it and slowing everyone else behind them down.
No, I was hoping you wouldn't say this because those are the people I hate the most. I wanted that to be my number one, you know, most hated subject, which is, you know, there are a lot of people here in New York City where I live. Get out of the subway, man. Get to the street. Then you can check your phone. But on the dinner table thing, I think that's definitely my mother's most hated. And probably my most annoying habit is checking my Twitter too often. I've been called out at the family dinner table when I am with my parents for that one. What about you? What do you do the worst?
Oh, man. Well, this is the supreme irony, Lizzie, is I'm actually the one that I hate the most is also the one that I have done before and been guilty of doing, which is looking at my phone while I am on the street and slowing down people. So I'm a total hypocrite.
Yeah,
you know?
I just knocked you over.
You know, I think these are things that we hate, but that we also sometimes are guilty of.
Okay, so fine. Let's quit. Let's hit the theme of this show and, you know, digitally detox. When I went on vacation, I deleted my Marketplace email from my phone so that I wouldn't talk to you guys at all. So how do we quit these things?
They say the first step is admitting you have a problem. And that might mean you be brave and ask the people around you if they're not telling you already, which in my case, they usually are. You know, what your bad habits are and get them to tell you. I mean, that's a little bit dangerous of a suggestion, but I think in some ways it can be good, right? And if you actually devote brain power to your habit, I think you can beat it. Think about it when you're in danger of doing it. Don't let yourself get into bed until you put the computing device down, for instance, or maybe put it down in another room. You know, if we can be more mindful of this stuff, we can actually and just know when we're going to do it, potentially, I think we can actually start to avoid doing it.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you, Lizzie.
My general mantra for most stories about money is that they're really about choices. Or, in the case of our next story, when making choices stops. In Pennsylvania right now, lawmakers are at a stalemate over the state budget. Here's a Republican state senator, Scott Wagner.
The taxpayers are continuing to pay every single day, and we need to start pounding on that. And I'll be honest with you, I'm tired of taking blame for the budget. The blame's down that hall up on the second floor.
Since funding for schools comes from the state's budget, most schools in the area have been living off loans for school funding. Here's Democratic Auditor General Eugene DePasquale.
These are school districts from all over the state of Pennsylvania. They are rural, suburban, and urban. And the cost is going to go up each and every month.
It is so bad that teachers at one school started the year working for free before school funding came through. Like this one, Daria Jackson.
Well, as of right now, as you see, our lights are on, the water's running, so everyone's getting prepared. You can see everyone's ready, and we're hopeful, and I believe everything will work out eventually.
Mary Wilson covers the state capitol for Pennsylvania's public radio stations, and she spoke to us from there. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the ground-level school funding stuff, what is going on with the budget? Why this debate?
We've got your classic divided government scenario right now. A first-term Democratic governor who campaigned on big initiatives of more spending for schools, for various programs. And we've got a legislature that's got huge Republican majorities and lawmakers who are very much against broad, what they call broad-based tax increases, which are the ways in which the governor right now wants to increase spending. So we've got this kind of trench warfare going on that's been stretching, you know, since the summer began.
And this is one of those issues, though, where, you know, this is not uncommon in states around the country, but schools have ended up in the middle of it. So why did that happen?
So when the state doesn't have a budget, state agencies are still funded, state employees are still funded, prisons and parks stay open. But the state, you know, for some quirk of the way we work, the state loses the authority to pay contractors, and that affects the way schools get their state funding. Their state aid is the way we refer to it here. So it's just a matter of legal authority. The state is still collecting taxes and fees, so it still has money in its coffers, but it can't legally spend that on schools without a spending plan, a budget that tells it how to do that.
So what does that mean for the schools?
School districts aren't getting their state funding, and that is a problem, first and foremost, for school districts that don't have much money besides state funding. So if you're a poorer school district, if you don't have much of a tax base, then the lack of state funding coming in, the first payments, I believe, happen in August, and there's another big one in September, that really hurts those school districts. Pennsylvania's got a lot of Rust Belt communities, places where the tax base has really emptied out, and those school districts are starting to hurt. According to federal data, we've got the most inequitable school funding issue in the country. Pennsylvania has the second most number of schools that have been called not creditworthy. Their bonds are at junk status. Michigan is the only state that has more schools with that status, according to Moody's. So things are already not so great in terms of how schools can find their own funding. So state aid is pretty important to many schools here.
So if they have to, say, you know, take out loans to keep going, you're talking about their creditworthiness. Does that mean they're, you know, paying lots of interest and doing that kind of stuff to try and make the math work?
That's absolutely right. Schools have started taking out loans. We've got about 17, maybe 16 schools that have already taken out loans of $10 million or less. And the biggest city school district here, Philadelphia, has taken out a loan of $275 million. And all those loans together have interest payments of about $11 million. And that's expected to go up with this next month if there's no state budget that's finalized.
I think about this issue, and on the one hand, it seems like, you know, bureaucratic infighting. On the other hand, we're talking about children who, you know, would ultimately be the people probably paying the price in this sense. What's the outlook? Are we going to get to a point where this impacts kids' education?
I have heard from people who will not put their name next to it that the minute a school closes, the entire dynamic at the Capitol and the bureaucratic infighting, as you refer to it, the entire dynamic there changes. That once you close a school, that becomes like the kind of event you can't ignore. We're not there yet. Where we are right now is school districts that have been financially distressed for years are having trouble, and one of the most distressed school districts in the state has said it can't pay its teachers right now. But we haven't seen kind of these mid-tier schools actually close their doors, although they are threatening to do so.
Wow.
You know, if this drags on.
Mary Wilson, who covers the state capitol for Pennsylvania's public radio stations, thank you so much for your reporting.
Oh, my privilege.
Temperatures are starting to drop around the country now, and for a lot of big cities, that means getting ready to house homeless citizens during the fall and winter. Portland, Oregon, Los Angeles, and New York have all announced multi-million-dollar efforts to try to stop homelessness. New York, where our show is based, is different from most big cities. There are about 60,000 people who live in shelters here, and if you need a bed, the city has to find it for you. That's thanks largely to the efforts of one man. Marketplace's Noel King has this story.
This story starts in a New York neighborhood called the Bowery in 1979. Kim Hopper was a grad student documenting how mentally ill New Yorkers survived there. He hung out at McSorley's, a bar that's still in the neighborhood. I met him there. He says the Bowery was known for three things.
Commercial lighting shops, flop houses, and a couple of very famous punk rock clubs.
It was New York's Skid Row. Hopper's now a professor at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Even 35 years later, he remembers.
Unless you could find a place to squirrel yourself away during the winter months and sort of catch some heat, you were really exposed to the elements, and that was a really harsh place to be.
Around that time, Hopper was introduced to Robert Hayes, a 26-year-old lawyer trying to do something unprecedented, to prove in court that New York City had a legal responsibility to shelter its thousands of homeless.
Here's this Wall Street lawyer who thinks he can move heaven and hell, let alone the city and state, to establish a right to shelter for people that nobody gave a damn about.
Robert Hayes is in his 60s now. He's gone gray, but still has lots of energy. He's the CEO of the nonprofit Community Healthcare Network. In 79, he was a newly minted securities and antitrust litigator at a white shoe law firm. He had a habit of chatting with the men who lived on the streets around NYU Law School.
Most people in New York either ignored homeless people or just figured they were out there by choice, kind of free thinkers, free livers, or down and out drunks.
But they were telling him living on the streets wasn't a choice.
I spent a lot of my spare time in the basement of the NYU Law Library and, you know, dug around the legal books. And we did find some nuggets that gave us a straight-faced argument that there was indeed in New York a right to shelter.
His argument was this. In 1938, New York State rewrote its constitution. This was during the Depression, and a provision was added that said the following. The aid, care, and support of the needy are public concerns and shall be provided by the state.
You know, at the end of the day, the best argument I had was, Your Honor, the word shall provide emergency shelter means shall. Shall means shall. That's not complicated.
Hayes sued New York's mayor, the Department of Social Services, and Governor Hugh Carey. The plaintiff, Robert Callahan, was a homeless man Hayes met on the Bowery.
Yeah, you know, Callahan was a spry, alcoholic guy who was in his 50s and literally said, I'm ready. Let's take on this Governor Carey. It'll be one Irish guy, Callahan, whooping another Irish guy, Carey. So that was the spirit.
Hayes called witnesses to testify that homelessness, especially in the winter, endangered lives. In December of 79, a judge agreed, ruling that homeless New Yorkers had a right to shelter. But Hayes knew it was only half a win because the city shelters were terrible. So he sued again and had witnesses describe the city shelters, the hundreds of men sleeping on metal beds with no mattresses, the clogged toilets, the violence. The testimony worked.
That afternoon, the city freaked out and came to the bargaining table, and we started negotiating a consent decree.
Hayes knows it was a big win, but it still feels partly like a failure. Youthful optimism had him convinced he'd help end homelessness. The 60,000 New Yorkers currently living in shelters prove he came up short.
Noel King reports for Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty Desk. Major League Baseball season ends this weekend for regular play, and there's been an ongoing battle for the American League West crown between two teams that are both in Texas, the Rangers, who just clinched a playoff spot, and the Astros. And, well, they aren't necessarily there by accident. The Houston Astros moved from the National League to the American League in 2013 when they were sold. It gave the AL and the NL equal numbers of teams, and perhaps more importantly, gave Major League Baseball a lucrative in-state rivalry that's worked out nicely for its bottom line. Marketplace's Andy Euler, a Fort Worth native, came on to talk about the story. Hi, Andy.
Thanks, Lizzie.
I want you to put this in perspective for us, because these two teams, for a long time, had no business playing each other in a league playoff.
Right. It was just kind of once a year, the NL would play the AL. It was kind of a thing. But I should break this down for you, too. I'm a Texas Rangers fan. I grew up in Fort Worth, started going to games when I was a little kid. This is the first Astros-Rangers game that I actually kind of care about, because the Astros used to be in the NL. They were in the National League, and so we just didn't really care about what they were doing because the Rangers are in the American League. And so playoff implications had nothing to do with what the Astros are doing.
Having them in the same league, talk about the orchestration of that, because it wasn't entirely random, right?
Well, see, that's what I talked to Alex Remington about. He worked at the Washington Post. He blogs for Hardball Times. And so what I was kind of trying to figure out was this really kind of orchestrated and calculated, and did they try to bring business to Arlington, to Dallas-Fort Worth, to Houston by creating this kind of rivalry?
Clearly, just moving the Astros from the division where there were too many teams to the division where there were too few teams, by far the lowest number of moving parts. Plus, they had an potential in-state rivalry, and the Rangers were kind of happy to see another Texas team in the division because it would raise gate revenue. You know, I think it was just they looked at all the options, and this seemed to be the easiest.
The easiest, plus it sounds like a little extra money. So when you talk to people at the game, what were they saying?
When I was there, it was so funny because I saw a kid with a Houston Astros jersey on. It turns out he was going to school at North Texas in Denton, about half an hour north of Dallas-Fort Worth. He grew up in Houston, but his dad drove the 3.5 hours to check out the game with his son, so I got to talking to him.
I've always taken pride in my team. I just think I've taken more pride in representing it, because people automatically assume if I'm in the DFW area that I'm possibly a Rangers fan, which I'm not, because I'm originally from Houston and grew up an Astros fan. Whether, you know, MLB or Bud Selig wants to admit it or not, I feel that they did create the rivalry, not just in the league, but in the division, putting them specifically in the AL West where the Rangers were already placed.
See, that's what was so interesting to me, too, is that he said he takes more pride because he lives in the DFW area now, so he wears more Astros hats, he wears more jerseys. He actually kind of relishes in being somebody who is a Houston Astros fan now living in DFW.
in some ways, this feels like the sports equivalent of having a bunch of gas stations on the same corner. Has this worked out well for MLB as a business decision, having these two teams so close?
I think that it has. I was talking to folks actually at the stadium in Arlington that work there. They said, like we were saying earlier, gate sales are up. Also, the Rangers ran a campaign where you were supposed to wear red to the game because you were redding out the Astros. They were definitely drumming up this whole idea of this is a rivalry. And again, not cynical, but at least calculated enough to where it's like, oh, well, if I didn't bring my red shirt, okay, sure, I'll go buy one because I have a favorite player and because, you know, I should really get into this because this is a rivalry and we're going to be playing the Astros for years to come now. And so, sure, I'll wear that shirt for another 5 years. Who knows?
Marketplace's Andy Euler, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
One thing we do know about the postseason is that for the first time in 7 years, the Chicago Cubs will be playing. Well, at least for one game. On Wednesday, they face off in a one-game playoff against the Pittsburgh Pirates for the right to move on and play the St. Louis Cardinals. Dan Semitovich, Chicago Cubs superfan and this show's senior producer, couldn't be more thrilled. Seriously, it's ridiculous. And all this got him thinking about the financial toll the Cubs have taken on him. So remember those bad financial habits we talked about at the beginning of the show? We will stipulate that what you're about to hear definitely falls into that category.
I was born in Chicago, Illinois. We moved away when I was relatively young, and I've been wandering the desert for the last 25 years or so, always missing my home and finding any excuse to keep my roots strong. I frequently accomplish that through eating shameful quantities of meat.
Just imagine, delicious Carson's ribs, sizzling in their tangy, mouth-watering sauce.
But most often, it's through...
Holy cow!
God help me, the Chicago Cubs. I fall into that needs help category of fan. I have that guy who gets wary looks when someone comes into my office for the first time and sees a beautiful mind-like collection of Cubs memorabilia. So this big marketplace, I thought it'd be a useful exercise to sum up all the money I've spent, whether I had it or not, on the Cubbies over the years. Okay, here we go. $35 is how much I spent on the frame for this rare 45 of the 1969 Chicago Cubs classic, Hey Hey Holy Mackerel. Here, give it a listen.
Hey Hey Holy Mackerel, no doubt about it, the Cubs are on their way. The Cubs are gonna hit today.
Pure gold. They were supposed to win it all that year. They didn't. And then I have about 10 collectible pennants, including one from, again, 1984, that celebrates the World Series champion Chicago Cubs. It was supposed to happen that year, too. It didn't. But yeah, about $100 for all of those. My number 23 Ryne Sandberg 1984 throwback jersey, $120. My Cubs baseball card collection, about $200. Various tickets to Cub games, home at Wrigley Field or away at whichever city I happened to be living in when they came to town, about $3,000. Beer and meat at those games, well, it felt like $4,000, but it was really around $250. And then there's all the Cubs bric-a-brac. Mugs, pens, baseballs, t-shirts, hats, collectible this's and that's, collars for the dog. You get the picture. I estimate all that at around $750. All told, that's about $4,500. And now here I stand, staring down the financial abyss of a potential championship run. If they beat the Pirates and advance to the NLDS to face the Cardinals, the hated Cardinals, I might just need to plan a trip to St. Louis. If they beat the Cardinals and advance to the National League Championship, it's time to raid the savings account. And good Lord, if they make it to the World Series? Oh man, I will be in Chicago. I will be at Wrigley Field. I have no idea yet how I'd afford that. Anyone out there want to buy a kidney?
Go, go, go! Chicago Cubs! Win, win, win that game!
That's Dan Semitovich, Marketplace Weekend senior producer and crazy person. And that's our show for this week. Over the next few weeks, we want to hear from you. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Come tell us at marketplaceweekend.org. We're working your stories into the show. Our show is produced by Haley Hirschman and Raghu Manavalan. Dan Semitovich is our Cubs Freak senior producer, and Jake Gorski is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.